How many of you are with us for the first time today? Oh, several, okay. So I should probably say a little bit about my own background on this agenda and why I'm writing and talking about it. I currently work with the coalition called Churches for Middle East Peace, do the grassroots organizing in Minnesota for that group. That is a group of 23 Christian denominational offices in Washington, D.C., who relate to federal government concerns and federal policy issues. But they have come together on the Israel-Palestine agenda to do advocacy with the U.S. government, with Congress, and with the administration as well, and been in existence for maybe 20 years or so. But what we do is we lobby with members of Congress when they're in their home districts. We send messages, communications to them when they're in Washington on the Israel-Palestine quest for peace. And so I've been doing that as a volunteer in my retirement years. But my involvement with this particular issue really goes back to the early 90s or the late 80s, when my pastor, Don Luther at Lutheran Church of Christ the Redeemer in Minneapolis, spent some sabbatical time at Tontour, an ecumenical study center. Have you been there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
On the border between Bethlehem and Jerusalem. It's really sponsored by the Vatican. But he was there for a summer, and he got to know the people at Christmas Lutheran Church in Bethlehem, Palestinian Lutheran congregation. And he came back and asked our congregation if we have any interest in forming an ongoing relationship with them. And we said, sure. So we've had that relationship now for over 20 years. We've had visiting groups both directions, back and forth. We've had a lot of connection with that congregation and its very creative ministries. They have a lot of things going on. It's a tiny congregation, but the folks there, led by their pastor, Mitri Rahib, are very good at raising money worldwide to do all kinds of things. They have a wellness center. They have all the Lutheran congregations in Palestine have schools, and they have that. That continues. But recently they've opened a college, a two-year college. They have a number of services for visiting groups. They have a guest house, they have a restaurant, they have guide service, and they often work with U.S. travel agencies that are setting up pilgrimage visits by groups from the U.S. And you've worked with,
yes,
with them,
group travel.
Both group travel in the Twin Cities area, and group travel then works with the people at Christmas Lutheran to make arrangements on the ground there. The other thing that our congregation has done in connection with Christmas Lutheran is about 10 years ago, their pastor told us that they were looking for a way to get their pipe organ rebuilt. They have a pipe organ built in Berlin in the 1890s. All of the Lutheran work in Palestine is based on missionary activity by German Lutherans in the 19th century. So there are now, I think, six congregations. They all have German heritage. You see in their stained glass windows in their churches, German texts, not Arabic, but German. You have a feeling you're in Bavaria or someplace like that when you're worshiping with them. And this pipe organ has on its frontispiece a quotation in German from the psalm that has to do with, O Lord, open my lips and let my mouth show forth your proclaim your praise. That's in German. Anyway, their organ was in complete disrepair, and our congregation in Minneapolis said, well, we would take on responsibility for raising money to rebuild it. It wound up costing, I think, $135,000 total is what we raised. We had it dismantled. We sent an organ builder over there from Minnesota, and he dismantled it, brought it back to Minnesota, rebuilt it completely. It's practically a new instrument now, and and then shipped it back to Bethlehem and got it up and running by for the Christmas Eve service on in the year 2000. So we've had that connection, and it's been a very rich connection. But that's part of my background. I've led trips there 5 times, and I've made visits not leading groups another 4 times, I think, over the last 30 years. So that's a bit of my history. I want to hand out a sheet that some of you may have gotten yesterday. It's really the statement of principles of Churches for Middle East Peace and about 8 or 9 other groups, Jewish, Muslim, and a couple of secular groups, working in Washington together on U.S. policy regarding the Holy Land. So I'll pass that around. On the other side of it is a list of websites of church agencies dealing with the Israel-Palestine issue. So feel free to take that. And if you already have it, just pass it on. Today we're going to talk about the use of economic tools to love our Holy Land neighbors in the quest for justice and peace for both peoples there. How can we make use of our money? How can we put our money where our mouth is when we deal with that agenda? And I know you can't really see this because it's too faint, but 4 points. The general use of money power to bring about social change. And how we've had some history with that in recent decades here in the United States. Withholding of financial support in the private sector, withholding of financial support in the public sector, in other words, through what government does. And then lastly, the positive use of money, moving money in positive ways to support, not withdraw from, but to support particular efforts. So, money power can be used to affect social change. I think all of us in this room will remember that back in the 70s and 80s, there were boycotts of certain produce, mainly things raised in California, but maybe also in other parts of the West, in support of the Cesar Chavez-led effort to form a union of farm workers. Remember that? United Farm Workers was trying to get going, and in support of, and the growers, the producers, didn't want the farm workers to be organized. And so there was a lot of conflict, a lot of labor owner strife, and many of the social change-oriented groups in the United States came together to support by boycotting grapes. And there were certain kinds of grapes or certain brand of grapes we weren't supposed to buy if we were supporting that effort. And I think there was some lettuce boycott too, wasn't there? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then there was the Nestle boycott. Remember the Nestle boycott?
Yeah.
And the churches were heavily involved in that through their world hunger efforts. Why were we boycotting Nestle? You remember?
Because they use dirty water.
To discourage their promoting in the developing world of infant formula as a substitute for mother's milk. They were heavily marketing infant formula among the world's poor, and the boycott was trying to get Nestle to desist from that by not buying Nestle products. I was thinking this morning in the presentation by Renita, that maybe we should again talk about a Nestle boycott, because Nestle these days is a heavy, heavy producer of bottled water, taking water from whatever supply, wherever they can get it, bottling it, and then selling it, and making big bucks on that, and with all of the environmental consequences that has. Then there was the anti-apartheid campaign in the 80s as well. There was a effort worldwide to divest from companies, transnational companies operating in South Africa. That movement in the United States even led finally to an action by the U.S. Congress to prohibit expansion by U.S. companies, U.S.-based companies in South Africa. It was vetoed, the legislation was vetoed by President Reagan, and it was passed over his veto, so it became law. So economic tools that can be used are both withholding of money, but also intentionally investing, both taking and giving, using money for both supporting purposes and for punishing purposes or objectives. On the withholding side, private sector, some actions have been of long standing worldwide. The European Union countries voted or agreed, I think it was 25 or 30 years ago, not in their trade with Israel, and there is a lot of trade between Israel and the European Union, not to buy, not to accept for sale in Europe goods that are produced in the settlements, in the Israeli settlements in the West Bank, in the Palestinian territory, because the settlements are considered under international law, under the Geneva Conventions, illegal. It is illegal under international law for a people, a military occupying power, to settle its own civilian population on occupied land. That is against international law. But Israel's been doing that ever since shortly after the Six-Day War in 1967. Today there are about 500,000 Jewish settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, because East Jerusalem is also considered part of Palestinian territory under internationally recognized borders. There is a Jewish peace group called Gush Shalom that regularly lists products that come from the settlements so that the worldwide marketing people will know what products are coming from Israeli settlements in the West Bank. The whole movement toward economic sanctions against Israel really took off in a big way with the year 2005. When a number of groups in Palestinian civil society called for the international BDS campaign. BDS means boycott, divestment, sanctions. So whenever you hear that shorthand, boycott, or BDS, it means boycott, divestment, sanctions. And the effort really took off worldwide about 5 years ago, and it's been growing ever since. You may remember hearing about the controversy that was generated by the Presbyterian Church USA also in 2005 when they voted in their assembly, in their national convention, to explore selective divestment of Presbyterian funds, pension money, and other money that's invested in corporate America. To explore selective divestment from companies that are benefiting from the occupation, that are profiting from the occupation. The one that's probably best known, the company that's best known, is Caterpillar, because Caterpillar machinery is used, specially built for the purpose, is used to demolish Palestinian homes and to construct or to prepare for the construction of the wall, the security barrier that Israel has been building in the West Bank on Palestinian land. Caterpillar has been particularly targeted. What's interesting, I think, is that the Presbyterians haven't yet divested. They've continued to talk about it. They've continued to explore what they call socially responsible investing, and to talk with, to have dialogue with companies like Caterpillar, and to try to get them to change their behavior, but they haven't actually divested. And yet, just the report that they were talking about selectively divesting led to a big controversy, not only within the Presbyterian Church, but between the Presbyterians and the American Jewish community. Many in the American Jewish community, not all, but many, saw it as an anti-Semitic statement or stance. And they felt it was really an attack on Israel. In a way, of course, it was, but because it was a way of questioning Israeli government behavior. But what I've always found interesting about that controversy is that the divesting from companies that are U.S.-based that are operating in Israel or the West Bank does not directly and immediately affect Israel at all. It affects the companies, but as our stock market works, when you sell stock in a certain company, even in the millions of dollars, almost immediately somebody else buys it. So the investment is still going to be there. It's just held by somebody other than the Presbyterians or whoever is divesting. And yet, I think the American Jewish community felt that it was a statement that the Presbyterians were making that they found offensive. And so there was a great deal of Presbyterian Jewish talk going on as a result of that. And in many ways, it's continuing to this day. The Presbyterians this last month, they were meeting in Minneapolis, and I was able to follow daily reports on what they were doing on the Israel-Palestine issue because it was in the daily press in the Twin Cities. They still have not acted to actually divest, but they've continued to keep that possibility on their agenda. And this year, their statement, which was really quite an extensive statement on the Israel-Palestine issue and how Presbyterians should be dealing with it, responding to it, acting on it, both in terms of advocacy with our government and with money. This year, they said, U.S. aid to Israel, which is huge, it's $3 billion or more a year, should be suspended if the settlement expansion resumes. Israel has declared, I think as of January, an 8-month moratorium on settlement expansion in the West Bank in hopes of letting the peace talks resume. Because the Arabs, the Palestinians, have said, we're not going to go back to peace talks with the Israelis unless they stop settlement expansion. So Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel, in January announced that for 8 months they would suspend expansion. Well, that expires next month, and they're still not back at the peace talks directly and not face-to-face. But anyway, the Presbyterians have continued to address how money should be used, both their own money, their church money, and how individual money should be used, the Presbyterians, and how U.S. money, U.S. aid money, should be used. All of that is part of this matter of how to use economic tools. Other churches, too, have addressed it. The ELCA has explicitly ruled out divestment, but has done a great deal of talking in the ELCA campaign, which is called Peace Not Walls, about the use of economic resources by the church and by church people, and to some extent by our own government, we as taxpayers, what we are doing through our government. The Presbyterians have been, I think, leading the way on that for in our country, but other churches have also been getting somewhat involved in that question of how our money should be used in relation to the conflict in the Middle East. On the issue of U.S. aid, that pattern of making major grants with no strings attached to the Israeli government year after year began as an outcome of the Camp David talks under Jimmy Carter in 1979 that led to a peace treaty between Egypt and Israel. It was the first peace that Israel was able to sign with a neighboring Arab nation. Since then, they've signed a peace agreement with the Kingdom of Jordan across the Jordan River from them. But they have never, they had never until 1979 reached any kind of peace agreement with an Arab neighbor. And Jimmy Carter really personally brought that about. He knocked heads together at Camp David until they reached an agreement. Part of the agreement was that the U.S. would make aid, mostly in the form of military armaments, to Israel for, well, I don't know for how long after, but it does have to be renewed, I guess, every biennium by the Congress. But it has continued so that down to the present day, we, from the U.S. Treasury, have given over $100 billion to aid. It is the largest single aid package to any country on earth. It is more aid to one country in the Middle East than to all of Africa, which is much poorer than Israel, the African countries. And of course, we're not doing it because of Israel's need, because of poverty and Israel's need for development. We're doing it because we see Israel as an ally of the United States, and it's basically, to help Israel's to be militarily strong. Part of that package was also aid to Egypt, which does continue as well, but it's not $3 billion. It's more on the order of $1.5 to $2 billion a year. Is there any chance that our Congress will ever act to suspend that aid or even to reduce it? I think not in the foreseeable future. My own member of the House, Keith Ellison, who is the first Muslim elected to the U.S. Congress, we meet regularly with him in Minneapolis, and he says he thinks the issue is probably the most the issue on regarding Israel-Palestine on which the U.S. Congress is the most united. In other words, there is very little interest in the Congress in doing anything to change our aid pattern. He says he personally would support at least a reduction or putting limits on it. But he says, don't ask me to be vocal on it, because if I were to become vocal on that issue, calling for an end or a restriction of U.S. aid to Israel, I would lose my credibility on anything else that I would say on that subject in the Congress. And he has been vocal on other issues. He's become very outspoken about the Gaza situation. He visited there shortly after the Gaza attack by Israel a year and a half ago in early 2009. Late 2008 and early 2009, he went there. He and a House member from Washington State named Brian Baird were the first American government persons, elected officials, to go to Gaza in over 3 years. So he's been outspoken about that. He's asked for Israel to lift the blockade of Gaza and to allow humanitarian aid goods and reconstruction materials in and so forth. But he says on the issue of ending U.S. aid to Israel, don't ask me to become vocal on that. So you've got, I think, very little support in the U.S. Congress for any kind of movement on that. Another thing that has to do with public sector withdrawal of money is happening in my own state. Are any of you from Minnesota? Okay, several of you. Okay. There is a campaign underway. It hasn't really gone very public yet, but it will next legislative session, called Minnesota Break the Bonds. Have you heard anything about that in Minnesota? Well, I think you will in 2011. It's an effort to get the legislature to vote to sell $18 million worth of Israeli bonds. These are bonds issued by the Israeli government And, you know, they're bought by people all over the world, both private and public entities. Minnesota has $18 million in Israeli bonds. Again, it's not something that if it happens, if the legislature votes to do that. By the way, our legislature in Minnesota has voted in recent years to sell Sudan bonds and Iraqi bonds, government bonds, as a way of basically saying we disapprove of what those governments are doing. The issue really is not to deprive those countries of money resource, but to make a statement of disapproval. And I say that because, as with the stock market, when you sell bonds, somebody else buys them. So the government still has the resource, but the seller is not identified with providing a resource for that government, for that other governmental entity. And so the attempt is to get the Minnesota legislature to make a statement. It would have to, of course, be signed by the governor to be approved, but to get the Minnesota legislature to say, we disapprove of what the Israeli government is doing, and so we do not want to hold any of its bonds. I don't know if it'll succeed. One of the likely co-sponsors, at least they've been talking with him about it, and I think he's open to it, is a fellow who's going to be arriving here tomorrow, John Marty. So you know that name if you're from Minnesota. John is the son of Martin Marty, a well-known church historian and theologian. And John is a senator, a state senator from Roseville. And he's more than once been a candidate for the Democrats' nomination for governor and hasn't succeeded in that. Well, he was once the candidate, and he didn't win the general election. But John is, I would say, a likely co-sponsor of that legislation. We think it's going to lead to a lot of discussion in the state political culture about how we view the Israeli government's behavior as an occupying power. And I think it will also lead to a lot of discussion with the Minnesota Jewish community. There are some Minnesota Jews working in this campaign who are promoting it, but they're certainly a minority. They represent a minority within the local Jewish community in Minnesota. So there'll be a lot of controversy around that. And again, I think the main purpose of it is to make a statement, not to withhold or subtract economic resource from the government of Israel, but to make a statement. And so a statement of a critical sort, a negative sort. What about positive money moves? Well, most of the church agencies that have addressed this at all have said what we really ought to do is to encourage the purchase, the intentional, not so much the boycotting of Israeli goods made in the West Bank, but the intentional purchasing of Palestinian products. And so you've got a lot of efforts, this is certainly true in Minnesota, I don't know about other parts of the country, through the churches, to import and sell through local churches Palestinian olive oil, Palestinian olive wood carvings, and so forth. But the main products seem to be olive related, because the main agricultural product in the West Bank is the olive. The olive tree is the primary earner of agricultural income in the Palestinian territory. And I think I heard once that 25% of all agricultural revenue generated is from the olive tree.
But they've lost so many.
They've lost a lot of them through settlement development. They've lost a lot through building the wall. They've lost olive trees through building the bypass roads that are for Israeli use only in the West Bank. Yeah, they've lost a lot of them. But the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem is appropriately named. It still has, it's Lutheran property, at least part of it, on the Mount of Olives, where the Lutheran World Federation operates a hospital, Augusta Victoria, and where there is surrounding it a couple score of acres. I think it's 40 or 60 acres of olive trees, olive groves. A part of that property is now destined to become the home for 84 units of affordable housing, and built by the Lutherans. And I'll say a little more about that as we conclude. But the effort to bring in Palestinian products to the U.S., and it's also happening, I think, in Europe and Canada, and sell through local churches products that help the Palestinian economy, the Palestinian agriculture economy, is another part of this picture on the positive side of putting your money into efforts to help the Palestinians who need all the economic help they can get. They have difficulty trading with certainly with Israel, but also with other nations around the West Bank, because the Israelis control everything that goes in and out of the Palestinian territory. They have been, for the most part, allowing olive wood and olive oil products to come out. We've got a guy in Minnesota named Peter Mann, who is in Brainerd, who happens to be a Presbyterian layperson, and he has set up a rather substantial business called Import Peace, and he brings in, by the truckloads or airplane loads, olive oil from the West Bank, and then gets it distributed through local churches, not only in Minnesota, but in other states as well. So that's a kind of positive piece of giving support to the Palestinians. And there is also church support, as you know, for funding human services in the West Bank among the Palestinians. There is, and in East Jerusalem, educational services and medical services. There is support for peace workers. The ELCA has for many years sent young adults in global mission to, for 1 year terms in Palestine. I know a recent person involved in that named Greta Stieber, who was, I think, here a couple weeks ago doing a presentation on her experience. She worked with a Lutheran school in Beit Sahur, the community next door to Bethlehem. And I think we had this past year six young adults in global mission serving there for a year, basically paid for by the National Church. We have supported people going as ecumenical accompaniers for 3 months, which is a program of the World Council of Churches working with the local churches in Palestine. Again, volunteer to go for three months and work, and they often wind up working in peace efforts. They work with United Church of Christ minister in St. Paul that I know has been doing that, and he was assigned to work with villagers in the north of the West Bank, helping as an international, helping Palestinians get through the wall to their farmland on the other side from where they lived. Because when internationals are with them, they have an easier time getting through military controls. So there's that kind of thing. The Christian Peacemaker teams in Hebron have been, did you ever meet with any of them when you were there?
Some friends of mine have.
Yeah. And all of these basically are church-funded programs. There is, I would say, also the effort to provide more the churches have promoted more balance in U.S. government aid to the two parties, so that if we're going to continue with our major aid to the State of Israel, should we not also provide major aid to the Palestinians, to the Palestinian Authority with U.S. taxpayer dollars? And that's been minimal up to this point. Much less than $1 billion a year have we been, on average, sending to the Palestinian people. So, I want to conclude by talking about a particular project that is currently seeking funding, the Mount of Olives Housing Project. And that is organized through the Lutheran World Federation. And the proposal is to build 84 units of affordable housing for startup families who are now in East Jerusalem, or would be if they could live there, and don't have housing, because the Israelis have forbidden expansion of housing in East Jerusalem, and for even, you have to get a permit to even add on a floor to an existing building. And the Israelis have regularly refused to give those permits because they are trying to, quote, Judahize East Jerusalem. They're encouraging Palestinians to leave by a variety of measures, and they're trying to populate East Jerusalem with Israeli Jews. They have, however, given permission to the Lutherans to build housing on the Mount of Olives, on the Lutheran property. And the proposal is to build 84 units, and it's designated for use by Christians. And the reason for that is Christians have been leaving in large numbers. They've been leaving much faster than the Muslim population from East Jerusalem and the West Bank. And it's a real concern to the existing Christian community there, whether there will still be, as they put it, living stones in the land where Jesus walked in another generation. The population, the Christian population of East Jerusalem, which was about 30,000, about, I think, at the time of the 67 war, is down now under 10,000 and continues to decline. And so this is one, it would be just a drop in the bucket, of course, but it would be helpful. They figure that with 84 units fully occupied by families, by an average family of 5 to 6 persons, you're talking about 500 people. You're talking about housing for 500 people who might otherwise have to leave, would not be there. The effort is to raise $8 million worldwide. One of the Scandinavian countries, I think it's the church in Sweden, has already pledged half of that, $4 million. The United States is asked to come up with $2 million, and I think we're currently at a little under $1 million toward the goal of $2 million. The Finnish government, in Sweden it's the church that is providing the money. In Finland, it's the government that has pledged a significant amount of money. I think it's about the equivalent of about $500,000. So that's underway, and if you have any interest in supporting it, this tells you how you can do that. You can send a check to the ELCA Global Mission Unit and indicate that it's for the Mount of Olives Housing Project.
What kind of surety is there that the Israelis aren't going to come in and cause problems?
Yeah, well, that's a good question.
I mean, it's
so far they've
owned and operated by the Lutherans of the world, but they haven't been very careful about what they bulldoze down.
That's right.
And they're not welcoming Palestinians into that East Jerusalem area at all.
That's right. There's always that danger, but so far the necessary permits have been acquired, and the plan is to start building in 2011. Do you, when you were there last, did you see the site where the housing will be?
Yes, yeah.
It's right next door to the Lutheran Hospital.
Gorgeous, right.
Right down.
Yeah.
It's exciting, but it's scary.
And it's, the Mount of Olives is a beautiful location for being on, either to visit or to live, or to work. You, on a clear day, you can see the Dead Sea. You can look right down over all of the old city of Jerusalem with all of its, you know, architectural interest, the Dome of the Rock and all of that, the Tower of the Lutheran Church down there in the old city, the Church of the Nativity. You can see all of that from the Mount of Olives. It's a marvelous location, and the Lutherans are very fortunate to have it. We have it basically because in the 19th century, the Germans, where the German government was allied with the Ottoman Turks, and the Ottoman Turks were running things in that part of the world, in, you know, historic Palestine, and a lot more. And the Turks welcomed the Germans to come in and not only have economic activity, but to bring in church-related presence. And so the Germans, I think, primarily with government money, because in those years there wasn't much church-state separation in European countries. With government money, they built Lutheran church sanctuaries and other institutions of the church, schools, what became the hospital now on the Mount of Olives was originally built as a hotel, as a hospice for visiting groups of German pilgrims. And it was turned into a hospital after World War, after the creation of the State of Israel in 1948 and the war that followed that. German presence there in Jerusalem has included a large Catholic church, the Lutheran Church of the Redeemer, which is right down in the old city near the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is the famous one that was supposedly built under the Constantine era by supposedly on the site of the crucifixion. And in Bethlehem, there's a significant Lutheran church building, and I've already mentioned some of the spin-off from what they're up to. But there are these five Lutheran congregations still functioning in the Palestinian territory, and one in Amman, Jordan. And the reason it's there, it's still part of the Palestinian church, is there have been a lot of Palestinians emigrating to Jordan over the last half century. And so there's a strong Palestinian presence there, and there's a Lutheran Palestinian church in Amman. You've got this marvelous site on the Mount of Olives, thanks to the, I guess you'd have to say, the cross following the crown, when the German Empire was linked with the Ottoman Empire. And that lasted until World War I. The defeat of Germany and the Ottoman Empire also was part of that defeat in that war. And that's when the presence of the Turks, at least in terms of running things, left the Holy Land. And then, as I think you probably know, the League of Nations said it should be under the mandate of the Brits to run, and they did, and they were supposed to get it ready for self-governance in the Palestinian territory. And the result of that was the partition of the land by the United Nations in 1947-48 into an Israeli state and what was supposed to become a Palestinian state, but that hasn't yet happened. So, yeah.
Did you comment on the blockade and the effort to actually bring economic aid to
Gaza?
To Gaza, yeah.
Well, it's true that Israel, from 1967 until I think it was 2005 or 2006, actually occupied Gaza militarily. In 2005 or 2006, Ariel Sharon withdrew the Israeli troops from Gaza itself, but Israel continues to control everything that happens in and out of Gaza, because access from the sea, access from the land, there's no access from the air, unless it's bombs coming in, but access from anything around Gaza is controlled by Israel. And so you probably remember reading about the flotilla, when was it, back in April or May of this year, a convoy of 8 boats taking humanitarian aid to trying to get into Gaza from Turkey, was stopped by the Israeli Navy. And they were taken to shore, and people were held, the people who were on them were held, and the goods they were carrying were not allowed into Gaza. And one of the ships was attacked and was led to the, I think, the death of about 8 or 9 people were killed. But yeah, that continues, and Israel has since said they will loosen the blockade and allow more things in, but they are still in control of what is allowed in and what is not allowed in. And they are still very reluctant to let in any reconstruction materials to rebuild from the fighting of, 18 months ago. And they say that's because the reconstruction materials could also be used for military purposes.
What about the, say, the United Nations response, or any civil, even our country's response to the way they seal off that part of a people's life? I know that Obama stepped on a lot of toes in Israel for being more realistic about a two-state solution and more insistent on that. But you wonder about the whole world seems to have neglected its responsibility to voice.
Yeah, the world community, I think, almost universally has been critical of Israel's attack on the flotilla. And the United States government has, at least in a kind of mild way, expressed its displeasure with the continuing blockade. And there have been resolutions in Congress calling for easing of the blockade. Some of that work has been led by my congressperson, Keith Ellison. The commitment of the Obama administration from the very beginning in January of 2009 to get the peace talks restarted, I think is legitimate and real, but nothing much seems to be happening. He did appoint former Senator George Mitchell as the special envoy to Israel-Palestine to get the peace talks going again with United States government leadership to press for final resolution of the conflict. But so far, the Israelis and Palestinians haven't sat down face to face to talk. They have been in indirect talks, which means one party will talk with Mitchell and his staff, and then the other party, but never together, never at the same time. And whether they will get to that point remains to be seen. But it has been, I think, it has been from the beginning of the Obama administration a priority to try to get those peace talks started and get to a two-state solution. And, Obama, after he'd been in office just a few months, went to Cairo and made a major speech to the Arab community, the Arab world community, about the intention of the United States government in relation to the Arab and Muslim people of the world, and that we were not to be seen as anti-Muslim. And part of that talk was to say that he was committed to get the Israeli-Palestinian conflict resolved. But as with, it has been true, I think, for now at least 6 decades, there never seems to be much movement. There never seems to be much progress. It never seems to get any better. And when we talk with church leadership there in the Holy Land, and we say it looks hopeless, they say, no, it is not hopeless. Don't take away from us our hope, because hope is all we have. Yeah. And they like to play that theme of hope, because they say that's what we have basically because of God, because of the gospel. That's how we understand that it is God's will that there finally be a peaceful and just settlement of this conflict. And I'm always reminded when I think about this conflict, how we used to say the conflict in South Africa, the apartheid situation in South Africa was hopeless. There never seemed to be any hope. But finally, and rather suddenly, there was change. And it basically came about without much violence. It just happened. So maybe let's hope that's in the future.
I think it's really sad that the media only gives us bits and pieces, and that which is sensational.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of if only the media could pick up on some of those people at Christmas Church in Bethlehem. I visited with a school superintendent who's been there 38 years, and the grace of this man in saying, you know, things are really tough, but we have to live with where we are and what's around us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's no more violence than there is in this room. And Mitri Rahib, his family's been Christian for about 160 years.
Yeah. I mean,
they've been Christian longer than some of us in terms of our European ancestors. And, you know, that's really sad. For instance, my lovely friend Joel next to me, I have a guy, Omar, in Jerusalem, who sells the olive wood. And we were at the end of our trip, and Joe and Dick wanted, $200 worth of stuff?
Yeah, something.
Something like that. And the guy says, when you get home, just send me a check. Now, yeah. You think Disneyland ever could do that? from somewhere else? Where else?
We didn't bring a checkbook along, so all we had was a credit card.
Just as loving and gracious. And yeah, there are some, you know, Arabs that are out of a sense of hopelessness. That's what it is.
Yeah.
They'll lob a homemade missile, which isn't much more than a firecracker. Mm-hmm. And the media picks up on that. But when Israelis come in there and kill 100 people, it's just, bottom line on the sixth page.
Yeah. I wanted to do another little footnote to all of our conversation. A particular interest to the Lutherans in the room, and that is that the Lutheran presence there is highly significant. The Lutheran Church in Palestine is tiny. These 6 congregations, I think, have about 2,500 baptized members. We have single congregations in the Twin Cities that are 4 and 5 times that large. It's a very tiny church, but the worldwide Lutheran presence is immense. And the reverse side of this Mount of Olives housing project sheet pictures 2 of the Lutheran leaders of the world who were at the wall near Bethlehem in 2005 when the Lutheran World Federation Council was meeting. They are Mark Hansen, who's the presiding bishop of the ELCA, actually presiding bishop for many of us in this room, and the Palestinian Lutheran Bishop Munib Yonan, right in the center of the photo. Mark was the president of the Lutheran World Federation from 2003 until last month when the LWF Assembly met in Stuttgart. And whom did they elect to succeed him? Munib Yonan. So both of the current and most recent presidents of the Lutheran World Federation are pictured there. On the right side is a summary, an outline of the ELCA's Peace Not Walls campaign. And I think you'll find that of interest too. My point is, the worldwide Lutheran community has a very significant role to play and a significant presence in the Holy Land. And the call to us to be engaged more actively in pressing for peace there, I think, is obvious. We have the opportunity, we have the legs to do it, and we also have the presence there to be involved in that quest. And we ought to take advantage of that.
Does that presence have anything, any strength with the Jewish community?
In Israel, you mean, or worldwide?
This worldwide Lutheran presence,
yeah.
Does it have character with the Jewish community? It sounds like they have character with the Palestinian community, but is there a vibrant
with the Jewish community in Israel you're talking
yes.
about? Yeah. Well, I think the Jewish Israelis are aware of it. I say Jewish Israelis because not all Israelis are Jewish. Some are, about 20% are Palestinian, citizens of Israel who are Palestinian, who are the descendants of the Palestinians who stayed when the state of Israel was created, didn't leave. But Jewish, yeah, I would say Jewish Israelis, for the most part, they're certainly aware of the international church presence in the Holy Land that has been there for centuries. They're aware of that. And I think they're aware of the indigenous Christian presence as well. The Christians in the Holy Land, Israel and Palestine, are about 170,000. And a little over half of that number are in Israel. Fewer than 50% are in Palestine. But the Israeli Christian presence is mostly in Galilee, up around Nazareth and in around the Sea of Capernaum, or Sea of Galilee. But there's also a significant Christian presence in Jerusalem and in the West Bank. There are almost no Christians in Gaza. Gaza's 99.9% Muslim. But I think the Israeli Jewish community is aware of the Lutheran presence. They probably know that Augusta Victoria Hospital, for example, which provides a lot of medical service to Palestinians throughout the West Bank, certain specialized medical treatments are available only there. I think they know that that's operated by the Lutherans.
They certainly do because they're trying to tax it.
Well, the government is trying to tax it. Yeah. So I think there is probably a fair amount of awareness of the Lutheran presence. Lutheran and the other significant Christian presence there is Catholic, Roman Catholic, the number of Catholics on the ground, indigenous Catholics, or people who are in the relationship to Rome, which includes not only Roman Catholics, but Latin Rite, Melkites, and others, they are more like 70,000, whereas the Lutheran presence is about 2,500. But again, the Lutheran presence is significant far beyond its numbers of members. All of the schools, all of the churches in Palestinian Lutheran churches have schools, and they intentionally enroll roughly half Muslim and half Christian students. There aren't enough Lutheran kids to populate those schools. So other Christians and about 50% of their student bodies are Muslim, and that's deliberate, because they do want Christians and Muslim kids to go to school together. And they have programs in religion for both Christians and Muslims in those schools. Yep.
Better believe that Jewish people are aware of us, because when we come into the airport, just a year ago, one of the customs guys said to me, "How come you Lutherans are so pro-Palestinian?"
There was a chance to be on the
really?
Box.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's yeah. interesting. Yeah.
On that point, I would quote what we often hear from the church leaders there, Bishop Muniv Yonan and others say, we are, when we're visiting, we are not asking you to be pro-Palestinian.
Right.
Or pro-Israeli. We're asking you to be pro-justice and pro-peace.
Amen.
Yeah. But you're right. I think we are seeing many of the visiting church folks from wherever they come in the world are seen as pro-Palestinian. Yeah. Any other comments, questions? Thank you.
Thank you.